prices. Mother of Plain in Townsend St. Mitchell's Plain. Call 021 391 3096. Secure parking is available only at Mother of Plain.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.
Middle East Report on Drive Time.
It is what it is. It's the Middle East Report on Drive Time in partnership with the London-based Middle East Monitor. You can get them on www.middleeastmonitor.com. Twitter handle at Middle East MNT. In today's show, Qatar pays $34 million to prevent a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Sisi and Netanyahu meet to discuss the Israel-UAE deal, which hasn't been signed yet. Small print. Further Arab normalization with Israel is waiting in the wings. But online to tell us more is Middle East Monitor contributor and well-known South African, Thembisa Fakoudi. Thembisa, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Let's have a look. Qatar, $34 million to prevent a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. What do you make of that story? They say they sent $7 million of those dollars for COVID alone.
Yes, well, it's not the first time Qatar has assisted Gaza. But this time around, it was important because the Gazans are in dire straits, as you know. But they've also helped facilitate some sort of truce between the Hamas and Israeli government, following what has been taking place over the past couple of days when the Israelis have been targeting Hamas installations and targets inside Gaza. So Qatar has done this before, and they have said that it will continue doing so. And most of the money, yes, it comes from the government, but there's a very big charity organization in Qatar which assists in such situations. Gaza has been under siege for over, you know, at least in the recent past, at least for straight 5 years. They've been going through some really hardships, including not being able to sometimes cross to Egypt, which has been the most closest kind of country that allowed the Gazans to come and do business. So the situation has been very tough, and one hopes that the $34 million, which was donated by Qatar, will come handy and it will assist the Gazans as they continue to face various challenges, not only COVID, but there's also long-standing challenges and needs for assistance in Gaza.
Absolutely. I believe it's Rafah Hospital, which has been funded by a private Qatari donor. Just to put that on record. But interesting is the back-channeling that Qatar is doing that's coming to the fore. For example, meeting the Israeli energy company and telling them supply gas to the Gaza power plant because it will save a lot of money. That I find quite interesting.
Well, as you know, Qatar is quite big in gas exploration and supply. And they have a lot of relations with various countries in the Middle East, including the United Arab Emirates, and indirectly Israel. So Qatar, as the major player within the gas business, they've had some sort of upper hand in terms of pushing ahead their own agenda and dictating how to go about helping the Gazans, particularly when it comes to the energy supply.
No, absolutely. When we look at the whole situation, do you think that Qatar will be able to play a significant role in, I don't want to use the word normalizing, but making life at least easier for the Gazans? Because it seems as if Qatar is almost telling the Israelis what to do.
Well, a couple of days ago, Jared Kushner, who's the senior advisor of Donald Trump and his son-in-law, was in Doha. It was an unannounced visit, and he had a meeting with the Amir of Qatar. And one only hopes that that's the beginning of a much more bigger, comprehensive peace agreement as pursued by Trump and his son-in-law. So that's the first point. But You also know that Qatar has continually played a role in trying to mediate peace talks and truce in Gaza between the Gazans and the Israelis. Qatar hosts some of the senior members of Hamas. Khalid Mishal is based in Qatar, and for a very, very long time, the majority of the senior leadership of Hamas was based in Qatar. Ismail Haniyeh has been spending a lot of time in Qatar. And those people who have been wanting facilities to meet in terms of mediating peace talks have always used Doha as the place where they could meet, since the Gazans could not open up their spaces to allow foreign visitors and mediators to come to that country. So Qatar has always played that role. So what I think Qatar will do henceforth is they'll continue playing that role. I think they'll continue trying to assist particularly Hamas, which is currently governing Gaza. They'll continue to try to assist Hamas in terms of trying to finding a lasting solution between themselves and the Israelis.
Our next story I find extremely interesting. It says, Sisi Netanyahu discussed the Israeli-UAE deal. I think we have to look behind the scenes on this one, because last week there was a major scene when the United Arab Emirates said, we want our F-35 jets. Israel is the only country in the Gulf, in the region, that's got those state-of-the-art fighter jets. And part of the peace deal, well, not part of the deal, it's not a peace deal, was that the UAE would get these jets if it signed on the dotted line with Israel, and Netanyahu tried to put a spoke in the wheel. I'm betting my dollar on Sisi telling Netanyahu to back down on the whole UAE thing, otherwise it's not gonna fly. What do you think of my little theory?
Well, it's one of the theses which makes a lot of sense. But there are several theses why there's been that back channel discussions or talks between the Israelis and UAE and the Egyptians. One is that Egypt has always been the main sponsor of negotiations in the Middle East. So the only time Egypt really gained or attracted limelight, both Egypt and Jordan, is when they were involved in some sort of negotiation between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And that limelight has, to an extent, been taken away by the UAE, who claims that they are the ones who've actually changed the mind of Netanyahu from annexing the West Bank following his presentation of what is known as the deal of a century. The Emiratis claim that they've managed to convince both the United States and Israel that it's not the best thing to do at this moment. And they claim that they have, to an extent, pushed back all the plans which would have been detrimental to the fate, economy, and politics of both Gazans and Palestinians in the West Bank. So that's one. So Sisi is trying to resuscitate himself as the main man in the Middle East, because he has lost that position. But having said that, I do buy your thesis, which also makes a lot of sense. Because, you know, the UAE is flexing its muscles and is extremely ambitious, particularly when it comes to weaponry, defense, etc. And we know that Sisi and Netanyahu have got an open kind of line of communication, and they continue to do so. But many people argue that the horse has bolted. I don't think Sisi will do anything at the moment, because the Emiratis have really entrenched themselves and have managed somehow to convince both the Americans and Israelis that moving forward, they are the ones who are entitled to arms, defense. They are the ones who are the rightful negotiators. They are the ones who've got the muscle to even convince countries like Saudi Arabia to support anything that both the Israelis and Americans intend to do or implement in the Middle East.
I mean, the UAE, as a matter of interest, is the second biggest arms buyer in the Gulf, next to Saudi Arabia, and that's a lot of arms. That's a lot of money, and I'm beginning to think that the Israel-UAE deal for Trump is not about politics, it's about the money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they also host one of the largest defense and arms shows in the world. So it is all about money. But, you know, there's something else which happened and very few people remember, that when Mohammed bin Salman went to the United States for the first time and Trump was seen showing off with Mohammed bin Salman at the White House on how much the Saudis were intending to spend on military. We don't know what really happened after that. And many people are saying that the only person who can actually squeeze the hand of Mohammed Salman to fulfill his undertakings when he met with Donald Trump at the White House is Mohammed bin Zayed. As Mohammed bin Zayed is known to be fanatic, he loves arms, he comments on the defense and army magazines, so he's quite a fanatic when it comes to the promotion and accumulation of arms at the moment in the Middle East. One wonders why. And there are a lot of schools of thought in that regard on why is the UAE so keen on amassing defense equipment and other army arsenals. One of the justification is that, you know, as they continue with their the Dubai Port Agency, which is the company that runs various ports around the world, they need protection because they are expanding very fast, and as we speak, they dominate the entire Red Sea and the Horn of Africa. So it only makes sense for them that they'll continue amassing as much as they can arms from various parts of the world. And in this case, it will be mainly United States and Israel.
Now, another story, further Arab normalization with Israel waiting in the wings. So what do we understand by all of this? Who is waiting in the wings?
Well, I think what's been said is that, you know, it's a matter of time that other Arab countries will follow suit. We know that, for example, countries like Morocco, Yemen, even Bahrain have said they're not going to do it in terms of normalizing relations with Israel. But we know the influence of Mohammed bin Zayed at the moment. I know a lot of people think that Mohammed bin Salman is the main man at the moment in the Gulf and in the Middle East. But actually, the main man in the Gulf and in the Middle East is Mohammed bin Zayed, which is the crown prince of United Arab Emirates. So when the United Arab Emirates normalized relations with Israel, it was a signal that was sent to all other countries in the Middle East, particularly in the Gulf, that this is the way to go. I mean, if you have heard in the past the foreign policy of the Gulf countries dictated by the GCC and the foreign policy of the middle of the countries in the Middle East or the Arab world dictated by the Arab League, and you have one of the major sponsors and the major player within those two organizations deciding to have a go-alone foreign policy by normalizing Israel, and we all know that most of them depend on the Arab United Arab Emirates for funding all sorts of projects in their respective countries, except for countries like Qatar and Kuwait, of course, because they have deeper pockets than the rest of the Arab countries. It only makes sense that it's a matter of time that smaller countries will be following suit. Those countries that are dependent on the United Arab Emirates, countries like Sudan, will have no choice if are dictated to or are told to normalize relations with Israel. They will have to do that, including countries like Bahrain, which are also very small and dependent largely on United Arab Emirates. And also Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia might take time because it still sees itself as the trustee of Sunni Islam. And by normalizing Israel, they might just lose that positioning in political Islam. But they will also have no choice eventually but to follow the dictates and to succumb to the objectives of the United Arab Emirates. So that's quite concerning.
To say that it's interesting, I think, is something of an understatement. It's almost like a sea change on the surface, yeah. Although we know that behind the scenes there has been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing or back-channeling, as they say in the classics.
Oh, yes. I mean, we're all surprised by the visit of Jared Kushner in Qatar, I think the day before yesterday. So you can see that there's a lot going on. And for me, what is even more concerning is what messages or signs are they sending to the Palestinian or Palestine Solidarity Committee or Solidarity Movements around the world, who for a very long time have been dictated in terms of their own direction by the Arab world when it comes to Palestine. So now if the Arabs themselves are now normalizing relations, who are we? Who are we? We are thousands of kilometers away from Palestine. We are driven by love and the love of justice and our association with, you know, religious associations. But if you're going to have their own brethren in proximity, normalizing relations with what many people around the world, particularly those who are part of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, regard as an enemy and the perpetrator of the harshest human rights violation, you know, it leaves the world in a limbo, so to speak. We don't know what to do now. I mean, what are we supposed to do? And what answers are you going to give, for example, to governments who are anti-Palestine solidarity campaigns, who will tell you, you know, you are more Palestinians than Palestinians themselves? I think now they'll say you are more Arab than Arabs themselves. And if Arabs are choosing to normalize relations with Israel and we continue toy-toying and marching on behalf of the Palestinians, it kind of sends a very, you know, mixed messages, and it betrays the cause, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Interesting, difficult, and challenging are just some of the adjectives that I can think of. Tembisa Fakoudi, Memo contributor, with the Middle East Report is the program, but Middle East Monitor, that's the partnership that we have. 3ws.middleeastmonitor.com, Twitter handle at Middle East MNT. Tembisa Fakoudi, as always, a great privilege and a pleasure to chat to you. Stay safe.
Shukran, Shafiq. Salam alaikum.
Walaikum salam.
Report on Drive Time.
The Voice of the Cape, 91.3 FM stereo.
In the news making headlines, the case between Palestine Solidarity